Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, August 24th, 2008, and this is show number 166. I just got back from a three-day visit to my friends Harvey and Melissa out in a little town called Ashland, Virginia, right outside of Richmond. Getting there was a nightmare. I literally could have flown to Europe from LA in less time than it took me to get to Virginia. I was supposed to fly from LAX to Dallas and then on to Richmond. And I told Steve when I realized I'd booked through Dallas that something would go wrong. You know, no offense to our Dallas listeners, but I've never flown through Dallas and had it turned out to be a good thing. So, as soon as I arrive at the airport at 7 a.m., got up at 5 in L.A., they announce that my flight is simply canceled. Oh, great. Thanks, American. Appreciate that. Well, they booked me on the next flight 5 hours later through St. Louis, Missouri. Thanks. That's because it's farther. Well, of course, when I tried to leave for Missouri, we got caught in a rainstorm and couldn't take off for another hour there. So instead of arriving at the civilized time of 6 p.m. for Harvey and Melissa to pick me up, I rolled in at like 11 at night. That's late for old people like us. Anyway, I did make good use of my time when I was stuck in the airport, in both airports. My darling husband, Steve, have I mentioned lately that he is a saint? He bought me a membership to the Admirals Club at American Airlines for my birthday. That means that I spent those first 5 hours at LAX sitting in a cushy leather chair with free Wi-Fi and even a place to plug in my laptop. So I got this great idea to try and record chit-chat across the pond with Bart from one of the lovely soundproof-ish booths they have for making phone calls. I tested the broadband connection before I left the cushy seats, and it was a very respectable 1.5 megabits up and down. It was awesome. I'm sorry, up is what's amazing, that it was 1.5. Figured, okay, this is going to be great. Until I walked over to the phone booth areas where it was just about zero signal. Ugh. Well, we did end up doing the recording, but I ended up in an open area where there were kids hollering and all kinds of noise, people talking, laughing, you know, having drinks, whatever. But I hope you can bear up with the sound. At the very beginning, Skype was being a bit grumpy on my end, so Bart's voice is a tad garbled. But as is often the case with Skype, it sort of healed itself after a while and it improved a bunch. Anyway, at least we got chit-chat across the pond. We didn't think we were going to have one. Well, that left me with about 15 minutes left. When I was first stranded, I wrote to Twitter and suggested that Twitterville entertain me, because I was stuck. Among many entertaining responses, Tim Verporten of the Mac Review Cast suggested that I make a recording for his show. I've been sadly neglecting my assumed responsibilities over there lately. So I went over to the soundproofish booths again. This time, since I didn't need internet access to record directly to my computer, I could, you know, go over and do them in the soundproof booths. So, I fired off a very rapid 4-minute recording. Here's where it gets sad. As I finished up the recording, I have just seconds to go before I've got to run over and catch my flight. I noticed that the big round record button on Wiretap Studio was still staring at me in the face. Oh, man. That meant I had not recorded a 4-minute review. I'd recorded nothing. So, I packed up my stuff, headed over to the gate where I had an uneventful flight to St. Louis. I dashed off to the Admiral's Club there, chowed down a quick lunch, then I opened my laptop again with the intention of trying again to record the episode for Tim. Well, here's where it gets even sadder. I take a look at Wiretap Studio and I see it says 4 minutes and 31 seconds on the screen. Oh, that meant I actually did record the review for Tim, but since I didn't think I did it, I closed my laptop without ever hitting the stop button in Wiretap Studio, which means I never properly closed the file, and Wiretap Studio was stuck in an endless loop. The good news is that I just fired the Zoom back up and did another recording at a much more leisurely 5 minutes and 35 seconds for him, and I think it came out great. I'm not sure why I got confused and thought the record button should disappear on Wiretap Studio. Some applications it does do that, QuickTime Pro, I think, has a circle, and then if you hit record, then all you see is the stop, so you can hit stop. But Wiretap Studios always still showed you the record button, so, yeah, I don't know. Everybody learns sometime. Keep that in mind when you listen to Jane and Rose later. Well, I finally did get to Melissa's house, and I had a great time. She and Harvey look at me as though I'm some sort of strange futuristic animal, but they appreciate the futuristic animal because of the technology I carry and upon which I depend. Melissa is one of those folks who believes that the Bible had a typo in it when it said, "The meek shall inherit the earth." She says it should have said, "The geeks shall inherit the earth." I like that thought better than those folks who try to put me down for being a geek, you know. They're like, oh, you know, why do you have to have all the technology? You're on vacation. Relax. Anyway, Melissa and Harvey are proud of me and think I can do anything on their computers. They're always asking me like these Windows questions, and I don't know anything about how to work on Windows, so I just nod and try to look like I'm really intelligent. They have DirecTV for broadband, and I use that term broadband very loosely. It was running under a megabit down and 200 kilobits up. That was gruesome for me, but not as bad as the cell phone service out there, because there isn't any. I mean, none. There's no Verizon, there's no AT&T, and there's no T-Mobile. Nothing. Zero. Nada. Not like one bar. Not like a teeny little bar. It says no service. Well, I did manage to survive and had a good time.
Dumb questions.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, last week in Dumb Question Corner, I asked the question whether it actually mattered if you had your headphones with the L in your left ear and the R in the right. I had always thought it did matter, but I didn't actually know why. And after I saw a couple of people with them switched, I thought, I'm going to ask the question, see if it matters. In particular, I sat next to a sound engineer on a recent flight, and he had them switched. Since it was an iPhone, I could tell because the little microphone inline on the headphone was on the left instead of on the right. I figured if a sound engineer could wear them backwards, then surely it must not matter. Well, my seatmate Martin happened to listen to the show last week, and he wrote and gave me an answer, along with a lot of other folks. First, let's hear what Martin, the sound engineer, had to say on this important issue, since he had his headphones backwards. He wrote, I wish I had a great answer for you regarding the reversed headphones. I actually never turned my iPhone on during the flight. I had just put the headphones on to help me sleep. Sleep deprivation, an 18-hour shoot day for the E! Show, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, explains the reversed headphones. Left and right does matter for headphones, since various music songs play different sounds in each ear or headphone for true stereo recordings. If you play some Beatles songs via your iPod with stereo headphones, make sure they're stereo, not mono, you'll hear different sound and instruments in each ear. By the way, impressive mic mixer setup. Oh, well, Martin, I am not actually using that mic mixer setup anymore. I'm using an M-Audio Fast Track USB interface with that same microphone, so because the mixer confused me. Anyway, Martin wasn't the only one with an opinion. Jeremy wrote in and said, most earbuds are designed for specific left and right ear use. They tend to be mirror images of each other, so the sound is better channeled into the ear canal. Apart from that, it wouldn't matter which way around you have them unless, one, for classical music, the orchestra layout has the first violins on the left, so it would not sound right the other way around, and two, for films, etc. The stereo should logically place the sounds where the image appears on the screen. Interesting. Those are good points. Joel wrote in on the blog, you ask about the headphones on the iPhone. I can't see it making a difference if you're on a telephone call, but if you're watching a movie on the iPhone screen and someone speaks from off screen on the right and the right earbud's in your left ear, you can hear it on the left and everyone on screen looks to the right side of the screen, you'll experience a moment of or more of cognitive incongruity. I think that might drive me mad by the end of the movie. Kids, just put it in the right ear. And finally, listener James, crazy listener James, or is it lovely listener James, had some comments on the subject. Since you hate music, I'm sure you don't care if you hear footsteps run to left to right instead of right to left and Pink Floyd's On the Run. It's how the artist wants it to appear. For example, when drums are mixed, you want the tom-toms to go from right to left, highest to lowest, the way you get the sense that you're standing in front of them. So in the case of music, it's more of an artistic decision. And if you want to hear what the artist intended, then you'll put the right earbud in your right ear and the left one in your left. Peter Boots wrote in too. He pointed out both the classical music confusion on location of the different instruments and the example of watching and listening to a movie. Well, I guess it does matter. I always just did it because it seemed like a rule, and you know what a rule follower I am. Let's interrupt this episode of Dumb Question Corner with a word from our sponsors, the lovely folks over at Screen Steps. This week, I'm working on an episode of Podcasting on Podcasting where I want to explain all of the intricacies of recording a Skype conversation using Wiretap Studio. It has been so delightful to work on this with Screen Steps at my fingertips to do all of the heavy lifting. I started by explaining where to go to get Skype. Screen Steps took a nice screenshot of how to download and install Skype. but it also allowed me in the text to create a link to the Skype.com website so people wouldn't have to, you know, hunt around for it. This is just a small thing, but since ScreenSteps creates beautiful HTML, it's just a natural that you'd want to be able to have links as you explain how to do things. A few weeks back, I told you how in the later version of ScreenSteps, you can not only upload to a static website, but you can also upload directly into a post on your blog. This is a fantastic enhancement for those of us who like to teach how to do things, and using a blog is the most natural tool to do that. A post on a blog is the normal time sequence entries you normally see on a blog. So if you're just a blog reader, it's what you see go up on the blog that'll have the date, you know, and they go by over time, and you can go backwards in time. Blogs also have things called pages. That's more like a static reference page that you usually get to by clicking links in the sidebar. I use pages as a place to put my tutorials, since tutorials are frequently not time sensitive, but rather can stand for a long time. I also do find that a lot of people find my site searching on the word tutorial, so I like to make that easy for them to find. Well, ScreenSteps only would let you post to a blog post, and I wanted to put it up as a page. So I contacted the developers, Trevor and Greg DeVore, and asked them, how hard would it be to edit your code so that I could also export to a post instead of just a page? 2 hours later, they sent me a beta update that included that capability. I know it's perhaps possible I have some extra pull here that not everyone would necessarily receive, but the great news is that after I asked for it, they simply included it in their latest update 2.1 of ScreenSteps for everybody, so you can have it too. If you've been holding off on trying ScreenSteps for some reason, I really encourage you to download the free trial and put it through its paces. If you like to help people on their computers and you're on a Windows or Mac machine, a tear is just going to come to your eye when you realize how much this tool will speed things up, give you professional results, and reduce a lot of the agony. Don't forget to click the link in the sidebar at podfeet.com and enter the coupon code NOSILLA, that's all capital letters, NOSILLA, to get 25% off. Ed wrote in with a great question. I'm not sure it counts as a dumb question, but I threw it in this sequence anyway. Just listened to your great show discussing Dropbox as a replacement for iDisk for BART. I'm a pretty new listener, so I may be behind the curve on this, but as I look for a replacement for MobileMe Gallery, which I use mostly because of its drop-dead easy integration with iPhoto, I'd be interested in options like Flickr. I think I heard BART mention that he uses Flickr on one show a few weeks ago. This, of course, might open up a wider discussion about photo editing and sharing services. Anyway, if you think other listeners would be interested in this, it might make a good extension of the whole what can we do to replace MobileMe topic. P.S. You can tell from these questions that I'm pretty new to this stuff. Maybe too basic for your audience. I don't think it's too basic at all. In fact, it's exactly what made me come up with the idea of a dumb question corner. So many times we think our question is too simple for anyone else to wonder about, but I guarantee you someone else has the same question. I felt stupid writing that question about the headphones, but I got somebody in the chat window just now chatted, hey, I've always wondered the same thing. So there you go. Somebody got their question answered. All right, back to replacement for MobileMe. Well, BART's issue in particular, he doesn't use the MobileMe gallery for reasons he can explain to you. So he wasn't looking for a replacement for it, but it does create interesting questions for me. Galleries aren't really Flickr's strength, in my opinion. But then you've heard me complain about Flickr before. Flickr's galleries are very basic. They call them sets. They're not very snazzy, and I really dislike the way you flick through the photos. They have a single photo on one side of the window with two teeny, teeny, tiny little square images on the right with back and forward arrows, and I always get confused which way's forward. Because the images are square in that little viewer, it's occasionally difficult to tell which picture is which. You have to buy a pro account for $20 a year to be even allowed to make more than three of what they call sets, which are really like albums. Except, I think a single photo can exist in more than one set, so that's why they're not like albums? I get confused. Well, I've also used Picasa web albums, and I like them better than Flickr. You only get 1 gigabyte of storage for free at Picasa. $20 a year gets you 10 gig. Flickr is infinite once you buy the pro account. If you don't size your photos down before you ship them up to Picasa, you're going to burn through that free 1 gig in short order. I did. Finally, I'll give you some opinions on the MobileMe galleries. You used to have to use iPhoto to create galleries online with .Mac, but now you can also use Aperture for MobileMe, which I have bought, but I haven't learned how to use yet anyway. Oh well, I'll get to that someday. Since I don't use iPhoto in general, it's not the best solution for me to use MobileMe. I was going to say in this section, though, that Apple's galleries are gorgeous, but I went out to see what had happened to the galleries after I made the switch over from .Mac. I was sad to see that they got rid of the really cool flash galleries. They used to have some simply gorgeous formats. They appear to be gone, unless I'm just mistaken. And I'm sure you'll tell me if I'm mistaken. I pushed every button I could find, and I still couldn't find them. If they're there but hidden, I really hope somebody will let me know. I'm actually very fond of the way photos work in Facebook. Once you put up your photos, the user simply clicks on the image to advance from photo to photo, and it's very fast to flick between photos. The main cool bit, though, is the ability to tag people in photos. So if I tag you, Ed, in a photo, you'll get a message in Facebook and an email telling you that someone tagged you in a photo. Gives you a link right to that photo. People can comment on the photos, and again, you'll get a message as someone commented on a photo of you or a photo you've taken, and give even a message if someone comments on a photo you commented on. It's naturally done in albums, just like a regular photo album. I think it's really about people more than about the photo. So I think Flickr is about taking spectacular photographs, and so you wouldn't necessarily say, you know, here's my family reunion and here's Aunt Sue in it. But that's exactly what Facebook is about the people. Here's another thing I like about the Facebook photo albums. Think about this. Your best friend goes on vacation and takes 327 photos and invites you to come over to his house to see them. You know how it works. He controls either the turning of the pages in a real photo album, or he controls the laptop or remote control while he flicks through images and tells you a 10-minute story on each one. Now, here's another way it could happen. Imagine he's put these photos up on Facebook. You can flick through them at your own speed, enjoying them probably 100 times more because you can just look a long time at the ones that intrigue you and skip past the ones that bore you. And you can make comments on the few that you find interesting. You make those comments and he's really happy because he knows you looked at his photos. It's a fantastic way to enjoy photos, in my opinion. By the way, you can even share photo albums with people who aren't on Facebook, just like I did last week with my new Media Expo shots. They were really easy to put up in Facebook, and I just sent a link down to the, copied a link and put it in the show notes. If none of these excite you, my very favorite web gallery software is called JAlbum, and they allow you to load your photos up to their site. JAlbum is Java-based software that creates spectacular galleries, and you can download new skins every day. I don't think you could ever run out. I think if you did one every day, they would keep making them faster than you could download them. And people are just creating new ones all the time. I did a full review of JAlbum 7 back on show number 81, but when I started writing up these notes, I found out they're up to version 8 now. If you want to look at an album I posted on their site to see how pretty they can be, I put a link in the show notes. The JAlbum software is free, and it runs on Linux, OS X, and Windows. That's the creation software. Obviously, from any browser that has Flash enabled, you'd be able to see the web galleries. I searched everywhere for how big the limits are for hosting your galleries on their site, but I couldn't find it. The only thing I did find was a message in the forum saying there's a 2 megabit limit on bandwidth speed for the free accounts and a 100 megabit limit for the premium accounts. I'm sure there's a limit somewhere on how much you can put in and pricing for upgrades, but I sure couldn't find it. I'll have to think about what other ones I've tried. I know if you get your own website, which is actually pretty inexpensive but kind of geeky, there's a ton of free software for making web galleries. I've played with a few of them, and that's exactly how Bart manages his photo galleries online, is he has a separate piece of software that creates it for him. Perhaps other listeners would like to weigh in on this topic. Maybe they found something as pretty and intuitive as MobileMe, well, as .Mac used to be. This just in, breaking news. While I was doing this recording, we were in the live chat over at ustream.tv. By the way, you should check out ustream.tv/nosillacast. Usually around 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, that's GMT minus 8. But keep an eye on Twitter, because that's when I tell you when I'm really going on, and this week I went on an hour early. But anyway, we were working away, and I was recording, and the chat room was going crazy, and Gita pointed out she did find the information on JAlbum, and it turns out you only get 30 megabytes of storage on their site for free. So if you want to get 1 gigabyte, it's 19, I think those are euros, which is like $2,468 in US dollars now. No, I think it's just double that. It's like $38, almost $40 a year. And then you can get 10 gig of storage for 95 euros. So anyway, it's kind of expensive. They do let you host to all different places. So maybe you can find another account that you like a little bit better and you can still use their tools because their tools are fantastic. So thanks for that, Gita. Willie sent in a recording responding to the dumb question we had either last week or the week before about the best way to delete podcasts on your iPod. Let's hear what he has to say.
Hey, I'm the Silicast listeners. It's Willie here for not a segment, not a review, but a correction. In episode 164, Allison talks about how to delete old podcasts off your iPod. She detailed a way that was way more complicated and complex, which are the same thing, than you need to. And surprisingly, none of you caught it. I'll try to make this short, but there are a whole bunch of ways you can delete old podcasts off your iPod. The first general way is to delete them from iTunes. There are two ways to do this. First, in the iTunes preferences, on the podcasting tab, the last option is to keep all episodes, all unplayed episodes, most recent episode, last 2, 3, 4, 5, or 10 episodes. A setting I would suggest is all unplayed episodes. This will delete every episode that you haven't heard. And since it's no longer in iTunes, it won't show up on your iPod. Something to do with DRM. The second way of deleting podcasts from iTunes is a program, $7 shareware, called Castaway. It does exactly what you would think from the title, if you add pod to the beginning of cast. Castaway is a more robust solution for deleting old podcasts. It's a lot like what iTunes does, but it has a few more features. You can choose to archive podcasts to a folder instead of deleting them. You can have it always keep the last so many episodes and always keep them for so many days. It will, of course, keep all your unheard podcasts, and you can have some different settings for different podcasts and different settings for short episodes of podcasts. And, of course, you can define what short episodes are. You can schedule Castaway to do its thing every day at some set time. The problem is it launches, does its thing, which takes up a surprisingly large amount of CPU, and then stays open. You have to quit it yourself. But that's just a minor annoyance. The second general way of getting things off your iPod is to set the iPod to only sync checked songs and videos. This includes podcasts too, I believe. And I'm sure somebody will point it out if I'm wrong, right? The way you set iPod to only use checked songs and videos is to click it in the devices list and click on the summary tab, which is the default tab. Then check the checkbox that says sync only checked songs and videos. One way to manage which podcasts are checked is to use, again, Castaway. In the iPod section, I haven't really delved into here, they have uncheck after how many days, but always keep the latest how many checked. But cap checked at how many megabytes, but always keep unplayed episodes. Basically, these are a bunch of options of how podcasts should be checked. If the iPod doesn't really care which podcasts are checked, here's a way to get around that. Make a smart playlist where the criteria is playlist is podcasts. Then set your iPod to sync that playlist. The second general way, which is the one I use, is to use the iPod's built-in podcast management. In the podcast tab, which is found in the same place as the summary tab, the defaults are set to sync all episodes of all podcasts. Now the checkbox is off, but once you turn it on, it will try and sync every podcast episode you have. But luckily, there are a myriad of options for syncing podcasts. You can sync the 1, 3, 5, or 10 most recent, all unplayed, which is different from new. The 1, 3, 5, or 10 most recent or least recent unplayed. All new. The 1, 5, 3, 5, or 10 most or least recent new. As I said, there are a bunch of options. The one I use is 5 least recent new episodes of all podcasts. You can also change it to selected podcasts and put a check next to the podcast you want on your iPod. Now I have to briefly describe the difference between new and unplayed. Basically, new is the little blue dot, and unplayed is the play count. The little blue dot goes away when you first start playing an episode, but the play count doesn't increase until you finish an episode. The good thing about using play count is that if you listen to half a podcast on your iPod or computer, then sync your iPod, it will still be on your iPod. And, of course, it'll still be on your computer. The bad thing is, what I do when I don't want to hear an episode of a podcast is select it, right-click, and select Not New. That way, it won't show up in my iPod, because I use New. For me, the benefits of New were better than the benefits of Unplayed. Now, this has yet again gone over the 5-minute mark, but I want to share with you a little tip about how to single out podcasts, or songs, or movies, or videos on the iPod. It's a little thing called On-the-Go Playlists. I can't remember what it was called. The way you add things to an on-the-go playlist is to hold down the center button while you have a song selected. If you hold it down on an album, artist, playlist, etc., it will add all the songs contained by that container to the playlist. One of the advantages of Smart Playlists is that they're automatically set up to sync with your iPod. I mean, on-the-go playlists, not Smart Playlists. Here's how I use them. I have a podcast episode I haven't finished, but I want to sync my iPod. I know that since it's marked as not new, my iPod will delete it. So I add it to the on-the-go playlist. Since it will automatically sync with my iPod, being ignored by the podcast manager, but being catched or caught by the playlist manager. One of the nice things about on-the-go playlist is if you navigate to your on-the-go playlist, which is by default in music playlists, you can make your on-the-go playlist a real playlist, and give it a name. From then on, you'll have a new on-the-go playlist, which you'll add things to by holding the center button. The bad thing is that you start a new on-the-go playlist every time you sync your iPod. So, if you do this multiple times, you'll end up with on-the-go 1, on-the-go 2, on-the-go 3, etc., etc. Before I leave, I want to give you a completely unrelated tip that Allison can edit out if she wants. Callie Lewis has discovered a way to put copy and paste on some applications of the iPhone. Now, developers have to opt into this process, but once they do, you can copy and paste within their application and from their application to other applications that support this. Due to the nature of the internet, this will probably be all over by the time you hear this, but remember, I said it first. Or second. Or third. So, before this 2-minute correction gets to be over 8 minutes, have a great episode. Stupid Twitterific. Bye-bye.
Well, Willie, I take umbrage at your opening comment. I did not make a mistake about how to delete episodes from the iPod. Perhaps I didn't describe the 28 different ways to delete them, but I did tell the listener how to delete them. And I'd like to suggest that you actually did make a mistake. You said getting iTunes to keep all unplayed episodes would delete every episode that you haven't heard. I think you meant to say that it would delete those you had heard, right? All right, it's a small quibble, but you said I was wrong and I wasn't, so I'm going to be petty and small. In any case, I challenged the logic of deleting unplayed episodes. The problem with that is an episode is considered played shortly after it started. I think it's like 6 seconds in. If you've listened 6 seconds, it's considered played. Let's say you've got an hour-long Mac Break Weekly, and you listen to half of it. The next time you sync your iPod, it would get deleted. It'd work fine for your Mac OS X or Mac Minute, since they're really short, but I tend to favor the longer podcasts as well, so I don't think that would work very well for me. I also think that the reason deleted episodes don't show up on your iPod have nothing to do with DRM. It's the way the whole system is designed. You control what's on your iPod by changing things in iTunes. So, of course, if you delete it in iTunes, it would be erased from your iPod. Castaway sounds interesting. I really like the idea of archiving to a folder. For example, I really like Cory Barker's Photoshop Elements Killer Tips podcast, and I want to keep those for future reference to rewatch when I want to use one of the tips. But it's kind of annoying to have them just hang out inside iTunes, and I don't want them on my iPod or my iPhone. You certainly do know a lot more than I do about managing podcasts in iTunes. I think I'll forward people to you from now on when they ask me iTunes or iPod questions. Well, Michelle wrote to me, Tim Verporten of the Mac Review Cast, and Victor Cahiao of the Typical Mac User Podcast with this software recommendation. I got to tell you, she did this. She sent it to all three of us, and it kind of started a smackdown, you know, between the three of us. But we came to peace with it over who would get to show it and read it. Here's what she said anyway. I figured this was the quickest way to let my three fave Mac podcasters know about this new Mac app you may not have heard yet called Social Addict. So let's see if I have this right. First, the problem. I'm signed up for way too many social networks, and I don't have the time to log into each one of them. The solution, Social Addict from TwisterMC.com. This one little free Mac app combines 11 social sites into one Adobe Air application. It almost seems like a mini browser window, and each network is under its own tab. With Social Addict, you'll find Brightkite, Facebook, FriendFeed2Go, HelloText, Jaiku, MySpace, PingFM, Plurk, Pounce, SocialThing, and Twitter. It works great. It remembers your sign-in information, so you just flip to the different service and update your status or view what's been going on since you signed in last. The only thing I think it's missing is growl support. I'm not even signed up for all of these, so I guess I should get on that. Well, thanks, Michelle. In spite of you starting our three-way podcaster smackdown as we fought over who'd get to use your review, this is great. I installed it on my Mac and my PC at work, and I can't believe how lean and efficient it is. As you mentioned, it runs on Adobe Air, the installation of which is extremely easy, too. When I first launched Social Addict, I clicked on the Facebook icon, and instantly I was in Facebook. Must have pulled my credentials from Firefox, that's all I can figure, which is a little unsettling, because I did not have to log in. When I clicked on Twitter, it did ask for my login, but then it came up so fast, faster than any other Twitter application I've seen. It's pretty simple and basic, the interface. There's nothing to help you do replies or direct messages, so you have to type in people's names all by yourself. It doesn't give you a way to review just your replies or your direct messages either, so it's very limited. But if you just want a quick scan to see what's been going on, what you've been missing, or just a quick time to fling up what you're doing, it's a great tool. This really does make you want to sign up for more tools too, though. Thanks for sending it along. What a great bit of software. This just in from the chat room on Ustream. I'm wrong again. I was wrong about saying that podcasts would be deleted if you said only give me the unplayed ones and you'd only heard halfway through it. It was hilarious. I'm yapping away here and Bart is in the chat room going, hello, hello. He's going, waves hands. He's typing in capital letters trying to catch my attention to tell me I'm all wet. So instead of having to wait a week for me to make corrections or to be called on the corrections, we're getting up-to-the-minute improvements to this show. You really want to go into ustream.tv/nosilicast and watch the show. It's a lot of fun. So Bart told me I was all wrong, and then I didn't believe him, of course. So Ben and Benjamin both backed him up, so I figured, okay, you must not be lying. It turns out you've got unplayed, and that includes anything that's partially played. So evidently they changed that. They didn't change it recently. Must have changed it a long time ago. And then new means you've never heard it at all. So if you say show, you know, only keep the unplayed ones, it will keep the ones you haven't played to the end. I love this audience participation. This is so much fun. Anyway, well, hey, what kind of car do you drive? Any chance you drive a Honda or an Acura? I know a lot of our listeners live in Los Angeles and Orange counties, so this isn't as weird of a question as it sounds. Our poor Australian, Irish, German, and Japanese listeners, though, along with those sprinkled around the U.S., means that even if you do drive a Honda or an Acura, you can't call Honda Bob. You can't sit in your easy chair watching a ball game while he does a major service on your car. You can't schedule your appointments with him when it's convenient for you. Instead, you have to take your car into some creepy mechanic shop at their convenience. Those of you living in the LA area must take advantage of Honda Bob's service since you can. Imagine the peace of mind of going to an honest mechanic. I know, you're thinking, isn't that an oxymoron? There's no such thing as an honest mechanic. Well, it's true. I've got 30 years of testimony working with Honda Bob, and I'm not the only customer with these kind of same experiences. So sit back and relax. Call Honda Bob at 562-531-2321. Or if you're a geek like I suspect, email him at hdabob@aol.com for all your repair and service needs. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
G'day, Al. It's Jane from Hobart.
G'day, Al. It's Rose from Perth.
That's not right. G'day, Al. It's Jane from Perth.
G'day, Al. It's Rose from Hobart.
It's still not right. G'day, Al. It's Rose from Hobart.
G'day, Al. It's Jane from Perth.
Finally!
So what's the topic of conversation today, Rose?
Well, I thought I'd tell the listeners about backing up their photos to the 5th-gen iPod.
That's an excellent idea, Rose. You go ahead.
You've been happy snapping all day and your camera's full. What do you do? Well, the normal way is to connect your camera to your Mac and download the photos. But you know me, I'm not normal. I do it differently. And there'll be a couple of screenshots in the show notes in case I don't describe the process clearly. I have an iPod camera connector. The USB cable of the camera gets plugged into the connector, and then the connector gets plugged into the iPod. Switch the camera on, switch the iPod on, and you will get a download dialog will appear on the iPod. Click appropriately and go and pour yourself a glass of wine, because this is slow. When all the photos have downloaded, disconnect the camera and plug the iPod into your Mac. Now, ignore iTunes, open up iPhoto, and you will see that iPhoto has recognised the iPod as a camera, and a download dialog has appeared. Press appropriate buttons, and your photos will be uploaded to your Apple from your iPod. And you can go ahead and BART and Photoshop your photos to your heart's content. The advantage of this system is your iPod is now a proper backup for your photos. Now, I know there are probably third-party methods of getting your photos ordinarily from your iPod back to your computer if you lose all other backup copies, because, of course, you have made several backup copies, haven't you? I like this method because, although I don't always have my MacBook with me, I know, shock horror, sometimes I leave it home. The iPod is always in my camera bag. So please excuse the choppiness of this recording. I'm suffering horribly with the cold and I have to keep stopping and starting. But there you have it, my iPod, my 5th-gen iPod backup system.
Gosh, Rose, you're just so clever. I'd never have thought of doing that.
Say goodnight, Jane.
Goodnight, Jane.
So what could be more fun than Rose from Hobart and Jane from Perth, but having them together? That was a lot of fun. But I do appreciate what else they did. They apparently had a little trouble getting that recording done. It took them quite a few takes, and they threw in an outtake for us, too. Hope you like this.
See, she was stuck at the airport.
Airport, yeah.
And tried to record for Mac Review Cast.
That's and it. Didn't put the press record. Yeah, exactly. So it's not just us.
No.
You know, this is our first attempt. We've got to forgive ourselves here.
Exactly.
When we finished there, I thought, yes, we did so well. But we'll do it again.
Well, the girls told me that we really should call this session Chit-Chat Across the Nullarbor, which refers to the desolate plain that divides Western Australia from the Eastern Australian states, stretches for over 1,000 kilometres. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Chit-Chat Across the Nullarbor. Well, it's time for a very special chit-chat across the pond with Bart Bouchatz of bartbouchatz.ie. I'm actually sitting in the Los Angeles airport, less than 5 miles from my own home, but sitting in the airport for a good 5 hours because American was nice enough to cancel my flight on me. Well, how are you today, Bart?
I'm grand. No one cancelled anything. Although we did find out in work today, we had one of our big meetings, and the shiny new building we were promised has basically been cancelled, and we're now moving into quote-unquote modular building, which is code word for a prefabricated shed.
Aww, sounds like a prison or something.
Yeah, but it'll be a two-story modular building, so we're all thinking whoever's downstairs will have a broom to bang up. Quiet up there!
Oh, that sounds nice. Well, I did want to explain about being in the airport because there's a baby over near me that we might get to hear from. There's a nice lady who's announcing everyone's flight except mine because they told me they're not going to announce my flight, just everyone else's. So that's always good. But we did still want to... The good news is I'm not really suffering. I'm sitting in the Admiral's Club because my darling husband Steve got me a membership here for my birthday, which means I have Wi-Fi and power.
Both very good things. And quiet, mostly.
Yeah, mostly quiet. Well, we do have nice little sound booths here that are completely isolated from the wireless network, which is why I'm sitting out where everybody is.
Yeah, completely isolated. Soundproof and radio-proof.
Evidently. Well, we wanted to sneak in a quick recording here because I'm going to be on travel, obviously, and thought we'd take this opportunity. What's on the agenda today, Bart?
Basically, corrections and follow-up from last week, I think, pretty much covers it. So, MobileMe Take 2.
Ah.
I think we definitely need to start with a correction. As listener Akim correctly pointed out, MobileMe has actually stopped using nasty, icky, full-size disk images like .Mac used to, and is actually using a sparse image bundle like it should. So that actually means it's not wasting disk space. It does still mean that you're not versioning your files individually. You only get versions of the bundle. So it's still not great for Time Machine, but it certainly has solved the massive amount of disk space that you used to lose with .Mac. You don't lose that anymore with MobileMe.
So, as I recall from last week, what we had said was that if you had a 20 gig mobile me, that the disk on your local mobile me would be 20 gig no matter how much you had in there. If you only had 5 gig in there, it would still use up 20 gig, but that was wrong.
That was wrong. That was the case with .Mac, isn't the case with MobileMe, which is, I'm glad to see something has improved.
Which is one of the best things about podcasting is how much you learn from people, because we don't know everything, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
We maybe know it all.
We could do more podcasting in work. That could solve a lot of other problems. Anyway, I suppose the other big news, of course, is that Apple has decided to give us all another 60 days.
Well, that gives you a little time to find your solution to get away from them then, right?
It does, actually, yeah. So they've bought themselves enough time for me to leave more comfortably, which is great.
No hope that they'll fix it enough to make you want to stay. But, we should thank all the listeners that send in links.
We should. Yeah, I don't have a list of all of those listeners, but I've another listener to mention, point number 2 on my little short list. It's actually literally on the back of an envelope, because this is very much a short notice thing.
Yeah.
It's on the back of the bill for my cell phone, which I don't want to see the front of.
What is it?
Anyway. So, what were we saying? Yes, 63 days. You think it's good. I think they really should have apologized instead of just giving us 63 days. I'm not saying they shouldn't give us the 63 days. I'll take those most happily.
But they did apologize, Bart. They said not our finest hour.
That's not an apology.
Sure it is.
Like I said, yeah, you try that and you're a kid and you just kicked someone's your boss window. Hello, sorry about your window. That wasn't my finest hour. See you now.
No, you made a mistake. You said sorry. You don't want to say sorry. You just say that wasn't my finest hour.
Did I say sorry? Oops. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, exactly my point. You see, it's actually hard work to be apologetic without actually using the word sorry, and I couldn't even manage it, but Apple did. I was reading a post on Tidbits, I can't remember who it was by, basically comparing and contrasting the way that, what's that company that rent out videos over the post in America that we don't have?
Netflix?
Netflix, the way they dealt with their thing and how contrite they were and how, I think they used the word sorry about 50 times or something in the email. And they acted promptly and did lots of cool stuff. And then they were also comparing to Google, who also apologized profusely. And then they compared to Apple, which was just a big PR statement about how, I swear we're going to be great because we're just fantastic and we're Apple. And, oh, by the way, it wasn't our finest hour.
You know, I do want to make one good point in there. At the Podcast Expo, I don't remember if I talked about this last week, but Shell Holtz, who does consulting for big companies, did a presentation on how important it is for CEOs to blog, because if you do screw up, it gives you a forum to say, I'm sorry. And they gave the example of the JetBlue CEO who literally apologized to the people who were left on the tarmac for 15 hours with no food, water, or toilets. And it was a horrible situation, but he did go out there and say he was sorry. But the next example he gave Apple, and he showed that blog posting they did where they said, 1% of the customers have been affected by the outage, and we're really sorry, but we're going to keep you up to date right here. And I interrupted his presentation and said, no, do not use that as an example of good behavior, because that's the only post they ever made in a week and a half. And he looked at me appalled, and he said, well, first of all, I'm taking it out of my presentation. Second of all, I'm posting about this. So...
It's an example of good intentions, but not of a good example.
Yeah, that follow-through part.
Yeah, missing. So, I don't know. It's good to have the 63 days, but I'm still not entirely happy with Apple's tone. But I may just be nitpicking by now.
It's
I fully accept that. I fully accept I'm probably being unreasonable, but there you go. So, next up, I got a very nice email from listener Lynn, or you might have got it and forwarded to me, but either way, it got to me in the end, basically asking about, you know, well, what if I have very sensitive files to store? I mean, is it wise or safe or reasonable to stick those up onto Mobile Me? And the answer is yes and no. You should probably wrap anything sensitive in an encrypted disk image. That way, you know, if someone manages to sniff your data or whatever, or if Apple lose it on a laptop or God knows what could happen, though these things happen, data gets out, then, you know, none of your bank information is actually visible because it'd be encrypted in the disk image. It does mean that you lose the versioning twice on that file, but I guess you lose it anyway on iDisk, so I guess that doesn't really make any odds.
Now, do you recommend using Disk Utility to do that, or would you suggest using something like TrueCrypt?
I think Disk Utility is just fine. TrueCrypt is just... TrueCrypt would do it as a file instead of as a disk image, a DMG file, but I don't, a TC file instead of a DMG file, I don't think there's really that much difference. And the encryption on those encrypted disk images is fine. I mean, I've never heard a security expert complain about it at all. It doesn't seem to be weak or anything like that. So I think probably just far easier to use standard tools. That way, if you're using someone else's Mac and you need to get at your data, at least you can. Whereas if you use TrueCrypt, then you've got to go install TrueCrypt. And, you know, I'm a big fan of keeping things as standard as possible.
I see. Yeah, I have tried using TrueCrypt. I successfully protected my daughter's taxes when they were on my laptop, and I successfully forgot the password and was never able to open it again. But that would happen no matter what you use, right?
Yeah, that would be the same effect everywhere. The whole point of encryption is there is no backdoor. There is no way to get it back. It's in there and it's safe. TrueCrypt has just such a horrible and horrendous user interface on the Mac that I have a hard time recommending it. I use it in work for the simple reason that we have Windows users and Mac users and Linux users who all have to get at the same protected information. So TrueCrypt is the answer for that. But the Linux GUI is horrendous. The Mac GUI is just horrendous. And I haven't seen the Windows one because I don't use Windows.
Okay.
So if it's just for you, I would suggest using just Disk Utility and setting up a password-protected DMG file. It seems straightforward enough, I think.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So there was another thing came up. You had been asking for ways to replace MobileMe, and one of the things you were looking for was a way to sync up your iCal to something online, what the right solution should be. And both Donald Burr of the Otaku No podcast and listener Caleb, who I don't believe we've heard from before, both recommended a video on Victor Cahiao's Typical Mac User podcast all about using BusySync to sync your iCal up to GCal.
Yeah, I haven't got around to trying that yet, so it'll probably be a topic for next week.
Yeah, no, that's a paid for
solution. This is what happens when we don't plan a show.
You would have tested it by Saturday, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. No, I haven't had time in work yet. It's on my list of things to do for the weekend. What I can say, though, is that I've been really pressure testing Dropbox, and it is standing up really well to a good hammering, quite frankly.
Oh, so what have you been doing to hammer it?
I've just been using it really hard. Like, editing files straight on it, hit save, and within seconds, the little sync icon starts to spin on my other Mac. It obviously uses some sort of push technology, because there is no way it could be that instant otherwise.
Yeah, it doesn't actually...
As I say, I have the MacBook Pro, you know, I'm working on the MacBook Pro, and I'm watching the Mac Mini, and it is just instant.
No,
hit save, it syncs, the sync icon starts in one, it stops, and the next instant, it starts on the other. And down it comes again.
But the file transfer isn't instantaneous. It's the fact that it starts doing the sync right away for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It instantly kicks up the sync. And in fairness, you know, when you're editing a Word document or whatever, which wouldn't be a Word document in my case, it would be a Pages document, it's quick, you know, because they're not giant files.
Oh, that explains a different experience, because I was really confused. I am doing it with big audio files, so obviously not instantaneous.
Oh.
But I didn't see... I looked everywhere for some indicator to show me that it was actually doing the transfer. Where do you see the indication?
It's in the menu bar.
Hmm.
There's a little thing that looks like an open cardboard box, and it has a correct mark, and that becomes a little blue spinny thing. And when you click on it, it then gives you a little status which says, you know, downloading so many at such a speed, estimating so much time.
Now, Willie, who turned me on to it, and I did an interesting experiment. So he created a Dropbox folder that he shared with me, and he's dropping his audio recordings in there. When I see one show up, then I move it out and move it into the episode folder that I'm gonna put it in the podcast. But it actually disappears from his Dropbox when I do that. It's like he put it in the box and I took it out of the box and it's not in the box anymore. I'm actually I have delete privileges on his box.
Well, it's a synchronized box. You've agreed to share the content of the box. So if anyone puts stuff in, it goes in for both. And if anyone takes it out, it goes out for both.
Yeah.
It is as if it is one physical box.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. That's not at all what I expected, but it's kind of cool. Yeah. The other thing I got to say is I'm sitting there happily working away last night, and I was waiting for a recording from Willie, and I was wondering, when is he going to give it to me? When is he going to give it to me? And Growl popped up and told me he gave it to me. And I liked it.
That's actually the one and only thing I have Growl actually alerting me for anymore, and there's a certain irony to that.
Because
I've turned
it
off for everything else, but I've left it on for Dropbox. Now, to be honest, that's mainly because I'm testing it, and I want to see how quickly stuff happens, and I have a feeling that after about a week I'm going to get really annoyed with that, and I'm going to turn it off. But while I'm watching it, it's fascinating to see how quickly the stuff jimmies around.
Now, in your case, since you're jimmying it around to yourself, it's probably not near as fascinating. But in my case, where I'm expecting a file from someone, or I didn't know I was going to get a file from someone, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, that's somewhat different. So anyway, I'm glad that's going well, and I'm stressing it good and proper, and it's behaving itself, and I have confidence in it. And I've double-checked, and it is in my Time Machine, and I can get all the versions back. So even if Dropbox goes horribly pear-shaped and deletes all my files, they're in my Time Machine, so they're all safe.
Wow.
So I have a lot more confidence in it than I ever had in iDisk. So far, I'm really happy with that.
Now, is it encrypted when it's up there?
That I don't know. So at the moment, there's nothing in there that I wouldn't want seen.
Okay.
So there's no bank account details. There's invoices I've sent out, but people want to pay me again. Go for it.
Oh, look, there's this account. I could put money in it.
Yeah, exactly. But there's nothing in there that would be dangerous for others to get their hands on. I'm going to look into that a little more and before I decide to put up anything sensitive. And the chances are, if I do put in something sensitive, I'll follow my own advice and use an encrypted disk image.
So now would you create... how would you do that? So you've got Dropbox that looks like a real folder. You put something in there, then would you encrypt that Dropbox folder?
No, I would stick a disk image, a DMG file, into the Dropbox folder.
Oh, okay. Of a single file, or...?
No, I'd probably put them all into the one.
Okay. But then you'd lose your ability to do the Time Machine versioning, right?
Yeah, but that's no bad thing for really sensitive stuff.
Right.
Because then it's also encrypted in my Time Machine. Because my Time Machine disk is just an unencrypted volume.
Right, right.
So if someone comes into the house and physically steals my Time Machine disk, they have sensitive data. So I actually quite like the idea of having it in an encrypted disk image anyway, regardless of whether it's being synced or not.
Okay. And then you could have a second folder of stuff that you don't care about encrypting if you wanted to be able to keep track of it a little
exactly.
more easily. Yeah.
Exactly. So I would only protect stuff that needs protecting.
Well, cool.
I mean, there's, you know, if I worked for the government, I might think about it differently. But, you know, I've made that decision. It's always a trade-off between ease of use and sort of simplicity and security. And you just have to decide for yourself where it's a trade-off. Anyway, so the real topic that got me fired up this week is the fact that we found out that MobileMe is even crappier than we thought.
Oh, really?
Yes, really.
And we were such fans.
This is not through some sort of, you know, poor server setup or something. This is through design. They have basically designed the web-based parts of MobileMe to be insecure. By design. Fundamentally flawed.
Aww.
Once you log in, right, it has secure login, which is good. So at least your username and password are going over the wire encrypted. The moment you're finished logging in, you get redirected to an entirely different domain. So you go from being at auth.apple.com to being at me.com. And from that point on, every single solitary thing you do is in plain text.
Oh, you're
so
joking.
If you're, yep. So all of your contacts is flying over the air in plain text. Your calendar is flying over the air in plain text. Your files are flying over the air in plain text. And your email is flying over the air in plain text.
So, for example, if you register with a website and it and they send you your username and password, that would be plain
yep.
text.
Plain text. Whoop. So if you're using hotel Wi-Fi, anyone in the hotel can basically know everything that comes into your email. Because once you're on the same Wi-Fi network as someone, you can have any unencrypted data that comes to their machine trivially easily. It is so easy just to eavesdrop on Wi-Fi, it's just not funny. So really, it's not good enough. Not even nearly good enough. Now, there's a blog post out there by someone saying it's all a big pile of overreaction. Right? That blog post, I have seen it torn asunder on so many different other blogs, basically saying that the guy basically who says, oh, don't worry about this, uses giant big techno bubble, which makes it sound really interesting. But it's really Star Trek techno bubble. It doesn't actually mean anything. When you condense it down, it becomes, we encrypt your username and password, but nothing else.
Oh my god!
That's actually what it comes down to when you condense the paragraph of technobabble into something sensible. There's a lovely article on, I think it's on Tidbits as well. Actually, I've been reading a lot of Tidbits lately, where basically the guy just rips it apart, and it's hilarious. It's a fantastic article to read.
Oh, you have to send me that link. We can put that in the show notes.
Yes, I will definitely, because I have it tagged as a clipping in NetNewsWire, so I will send that to you for the show notes. But I just love it. I think it's really well written. He also goes on to compare and say that, right, Gmail is free. Gmail offers you proper encryption all the way, and it's free. So you're paying $99 for the pleasure of having your email go through unsecurely.
Well, but look on the bright side. I mean, you can have contacts disappear. You know, you can have duplicate entries, and you lose the ability to edit your calendar entries online.
Yeah.
You have
and
that.
And everyone can see what you're doing and where you're doing it and who you're doing it with and get their phone numbers and email addresses. Isn't that fantastic?
That's neat. So is anybody making a plea to Apple about this to maybe change that behavior?
The blogosphere is quite full of grumpy people.
I wonder if they're
so
listening.
I think that's a yes. It's hard to know, really. I don't think Apple never admit to listening anyway. I don't know whether they do or not, but they certainly don't admit to it. I suppose the big things is basically it's all in the clear. Giant big no-no for using public Wi-Fi unless you have a VPN set up and that all your traffic goes through the VPN. And because it's using a separate domain, it leaves you rather annoyingly exposed to a DNS attack, because they can actually send you to the real Apple servers, and then once you actually have logged in, then they can spoof the me.com bit.
Nice.
Because it's an entirely different domain, so then they won't raise your suspicion, because you will actually have logged in to the real and genuine Apple page with real and genuine matching certs, only to be redirected to the bad guys.
So it's all good. They did it all.
Yeah.
It's consistent.
It's consistent. Though I read a comment somewhere, I don't remember. I've read so many articles about this at this stage, I can't remember which is which. But there's a quote from someone on a bulletin board basically saying, you know, if this is supposed to be Exchange for the rest of us, why is it so much inferior? You know, Microsoft, using Exchange, can manage to securely transmit information. And Apple can't. So, you know, Microsoft can properly patch a DNS flaw. Microsoft can properly secure your data. Apple can't, and Apple can't. I don't like this pattern. This is not good.
I'm going to lose my status as an ever so slight Macintosh bias.
Yeah, this is terrible. Like I'm being awfully pro Microsoft of late, and it's just wrong. It's, you know, Apple are dropping the ball here. We're paying for a service. They should, at the very least, pony up for what is about 90 quid or no, a couple of euros for an SSL cert. It's not a big deal. It's not difficult. It doesn't change how they write the code.
So there is something they can do to fix it that isn't a whole rewrite of the design?
Yeah, they just need to switch it over to using HTTPS URLs instead of HTTP URLs internally.
Huh.
That's it. Trivial fix.
Okay, well, I hope someday we get to have a call where we have some good news to talk about.
Yeah, we've been quite gloomy of late, haven't we?
Yeah. Well, you know what? My plane is about to board, and the children are getting really loud in the room here, so...
Oh, that was a quick 5 hours.
Yeah, well, it actually started... I got up at 5 o'clock this morning, and it's pushing 11 a.m., so it's been long for me.
Ah. Oh, dear. Well, safe travels, and until next time, happy computing.
Well, I'm afraid that's going to wind things up for this week. Please keep all the fantastic dumb questions, answers to dumb questions, suggestions, corrections, and of course the adoring fan mail coming along by sending it off to nosillacast@gmail.com. If you give Twitter a try, be sure to follow me at twitter.com/podfeed. And hey, come on over and join us around 4 or 5 p.m. GMT-8 at ustream.tv/nosillacast to hear the live show and even help me fix mistakes, you know, on the rare occasion that I make 3 in 1 show. Anyway, thanks for listening and stay subscribed.